Hello, and welcome to the Leader to Leader podcast, a Chime Foundation series where we bring the best of the best in digital health leadership to you. I'm Russ Branzell, President and CEO of the College of Healthcare Information Management Executives, or Chime, and the host of this podcast. The AI healthcare market is visible to the public more than ever before. More and more people are becoming aware of the benefits of artificial intelligence, the technology throughout all society and industry, but in particular, the healthcare industry. To many, it's solid proof that AI has had a successful impact in the overall quality of our healthcare system. Even as early as 2020, we saw significant increases in the AI trends with many entrepreneurs that were formerly skeptical, rushing to adopt technology in hopes of growing and improving the overall quality of the healthcare industry. Today, there are many healthcare manufacturers working together to harness and fully realize the potential of AI. From machine learning to robotics, to wearables, to sensors, AI is having a real impact. It's reducing drug dosage errors, streamlining diagnosis, detecting fraud, and providing efficient solutions for some of healthcare's greatest challenges. However, many healthcare executives are still just a little too shy when it comes to the concerns and adoption issues related to this critical issue. Part of it has to do with the fact this still seems a little futuristic, maybe a little bit too Star Trek-like. We also know that we've barely scratched the surface of what next generation technologies like AI and so many others, what we refer to as the fourth economic revolution, can do for healthcare and really truly transform and, shall I even say, revolutionize the way care is delivered across the globe. For some, that's a little scary. And today we have a special guest, Austin Walters, co-founder and managing partner of Springtide, to help us better understand really the venture capital, private equity world, but most importantly, around AI and healthcare and its really far-reaching potential to change everything in healthcare. Mobile coaching solutions to drug discovery to machine learning to, who knows, we may even solve world hunger with it at some point. AI is really the future of healthcare. I even refer to it as the next revolution, really, for healthcare. He's at Springtide, which is a network of experienced healthcare founders, operators, and investors in the healthcare space, driven to provide access and to support fellow entrepreneurs who are expanding access into the quality of healthcare. So first and foremost, welcome to the program. We're just so grateful to have you on our Leader to Leader podcast, Austin.
Very happy to be here, Russ. Thank you.
Well, we're in obviously very interesting times. Everything from the equivalent of the day after tomorrow weather striking across our country to still in the throes of the pandemic. So first and foremost, how are you and your family and your loved ones doing during this tough time?
Well, thank you for asking. And we're very fortunate to be doing relatively well. It's hard to stay inside most of the time, most days, but we've spent quite a bit of time out west where my wife and I are both from the Utah area. So more time with family than we've spent in years over the last year, which has been great. So some silver linings.
Yeah, without a doubt. And so you and I have got to spend some time together over the last few months. Of course, socially distanced over our favorite thing in the world, Zoom. But we've got to know each other a little bit. I'd love for our listeners to hear a little of your personal story, maybe dating back to that little trip you took over east across the big pond there. But tell us a little bit more also about your professional journey.
Sure. Yeah, I'll start with leaving home, I guess. So I grew up in a small ranching town in northern Wyoming called Buffalo, which is where I-90 runs into the Rockies. And the trip across the pond you're referring to is a mission that I served for my church in eastern Ukraine from 2003 to 2005, where I learned Russian and, as I like to say, got my life priorities straight. I came home and attended Brigham Young University for my undergraduate education and thought I would go into the Foreign Service. So I studied international relations and Russian, but realized partway through school that I was much too entrepreneurial to go into the Foreign Service. I had started a couple of organizations and a company. And so I applied instead to business school at Harvard. They had a program called the 2+2 program, which they still operate to recruit less traditional candidates directly from undergraduate programs into the MBA program. And this is an effort on their part to try and diversify the student base a little bit. As you can imagine, they get a lot of applications every year from consulting firms or banks or corporations. And I think this is a way for them to secure more entrepreneurs and things. It was a deferred enrollment. So I'd been accepted to graduate school and moved to Cambridge after graduating college in 2009 and really didn't know anyone and hadn't studied business and hadn't secured a job yet. So it was definitely an adventure for the first few months. And I took a job as a researcher at Harvard Law School for $15 an hour and read all of the Fortune 1500 charters and bylaws, and really actually enjoyed thinking about corporate governance and working with Professor Alan Farrell, who's an economist at Harvard Law School. And from there, I met, again, very fortunate to meet Clayton Christensen through my church community and first, but I read his books. And of course, he's known for developing the theory of disruptive innovation. And until he passed away last year, was a professor at Harvard Business School. And so as I read his books, I started doing some pro bono work for one of Innosight's startups. At the time, they had a $50 million venture fund out of which they would back disruptive innovations as startups. And so I spent some time doing work with one of these companies, Guaranteech, got to know the company, and they hired me where I spent 2 years doing work for a number of different clients, most of which happened to be in healthcare. So Walgreens, J&J, Medtronic were some of the clients I worked with. And it's been more than 5 years, so I can say that. But that was how I got interested in healthcare and began to understand the opportunities for disruption in healthcare. Now, when Clay says that word, of course, what he really means is democratization. So it's expanding access to something of value to more people, either by reducing cost or making it otherwise more accessible. So at the time, I started to invest with my dad into startups and alternative fund investment funds, venture capital, and support to support healthcare technology innovation. I also started to several more companies and met along the way one of my co-founders at Springtide, Dan Lambert, who was also at Harvard Business School and as a full stack software engineer who spent some time at IBM Watson. He has had two exits, one of which I had invested in as an angel. And so after his last exit in 2017, I had, by that point, graduated school, had three startups under my belt, one of which we raised $100 million for. This is a handheld ultrasound AI company in Seattle called Echonos. I had also spent 2 years in India researching medical device innovation with under advisement from Clay. So we were looking at what sorts of things are they developing that can expand access. And one of those was handheld ultrasound. It's a very disruptive technology, particularly when paired with artificial intelligence, so that it's usable by skilled nurses or primary care providers. And so Dan and I had both spent time in with artificial intelligence and in healthcare. I should have mentioned his last company is Board Vitals, which if we have any physicians listening, they may know this as the board exam study tool of choice now. So we thought that there was opportunity to do a fund focused on healthcare artificial intelligence and invest capital efficiently and smartly.
Wow. So you know, what's interesting is it's the world you live in and not the day-to-day traditional for most of our members. So it's cool that you're using all these terms that hopefully a bunch of our members are going to even have to look up, like some of the terms you're using and you know, the company actually went public, or that they actually are, what does even an angel mean? So tell us a little bit about your company as we dig in a little deeper into this. You know, what is Springtide Ventures? What is it? Where does it invest? Why does it invest in those? Why is it a little bit different than other companies?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So Springtide is a venture capital fund, which basically raises money from limited partner investors, and we invest that money on their behalf. And our investors can and do range from healthcare systems to individuals such as medical doctors or serial entrepreneurs who have significant investable assets. And what we do with that, so we're fiduciaries or stewards of this capital, and we do our best to find young companies, startups, that are improving healthcare and democratizing it in some way. So they're, as everyone says, reducing costs, improving quality. And we're particularly focused on artificial intelligence as part of our selection criteria. So we look for tech companies, they're software companies, so typically not medical devices or drugs that have a long regulatory pathway ahead of them and significant manufacturing risk and require a lot more investment typically. We're investing at companies when they're maybe a year or two old. There are multiple co-founders, one of which at least is a full-time chief technology officer with data science capabilities. And we invest post-revenue. So they have existing customers, an existing product, and they're ready for growth at that point. And so we usually invest $500,000 to $2 million into a company and take a board seat and help them put things in place to allow them to grow and grow responsibly. That's a focus for us. So venture capital is quite broad, Russ. You have many firms that are much larger than Springtide. As I mentioned, we founded this in 2018. So we're nearing end of full deployment, meaning we've invested most everything we're going to out of fund one, which is a $20 million fund, and getting ready to raise our second fund later this year, which will be a $100 million fund.
Wow. You know, so much of this is a world that, as I mentioned, people don't understand. So why just focus on AI type companies? I mean, that seems so narrow with so much opportunity in healthcare, as dysfunction as there is and opportunities for disruption, as Clayton Christian used to say, you know, why just that AI focus? What do you think the value there is?
It's a great question, Russ. And the reality is there are so many sources of capital for startups out there. And of course, the best source is customers, right? If someone's willing to pay you for your product or service, that's top of list as an entrepreneur, right? But sometimes you need more capital sooner. And you always want to think about fit. And money is not money is not money. It always comes from a place and their expectations that go, or capabilities, additional capabilities that go along with that. So I think initially when Dan and I co-founded Springtide and we had a third co-founder join us, Yanis Manavoukas, in late 2018, who has a regenerative medicine background, we had the most experience with artificial intelligence personally. And we just sensed that there was opportunity to apply this very powerful automation technology further in healthcare. So initially it was, well, what can we say something of value about? How can we apply our experience and skills in selecting companies? Because we wanted to be a smart money investor. So there are many people that entrepreneurs can find that are willing to kick in a smaller money into a company, but may not have the full capability to do a full due diligence. We actually look at the code of a company before we invest. And so part of it was just skill driven. And then I think part of it was just the, if you look at the last 10 years and technological trends, you have the Internet of Things, you have additional processing power, you have 5G that's on the cusp of being more widely adopted, you have interchangeability standards through FHIR, you have meaningful use, which did hugely digitize much of the data we have about patient health, and a number of other things that together have enabled a lot of opportunity now to develop software first innovations. Now, the other thing I would say, Russ, is we take a broad view of artificial intelligence. AI is a nice shorthand for data science or connected technology. And so there are also narrow definitions of this, such as machine learning, and then specific methods used within that, such as convolutional neural nets. We don't confine ourselves to a particular kind of AI. We look at that broadly and look for companies that really are using data in a significant way and data science.
So why do you think healthcare is so ripe for investment, startups? It just seems like everywhere I turn now, I hear about new things going on, new entrants into the marketplace, new venture funds. They seem to be everywhere, all of a sudden converging on healthcare. Why do you think healthcare is so focused right now?
I think there are a lot of reasons for it. So a few that come to mind for me are, one, it's really an enormous part of the economy, almost 20% of our GDP in the US, and it's been growing quickly, faster than inflation for a long time. So within that, there are significant inefficiencies, and software can address many of those inefficiencies. That's the easy part to grasp conceptually. And actually, there over the years, there have been a lot of Silicon Valley companies that assume they can apply the same approach to healthcare as other industries. And then they fall flat because they run up against some of the idiosyncratic barriers that we have in the US healthcare system. And so many regulatory considerations, protocols, workflows that are, again, idiosyncratic. And medicine is just really complex. So it has resisted winner-take-all dynamics. Like markets, you could think about Airbnb. They're the dominant player in extra space rental, or were before the pandemic. Uber and Lyft, LinkedIn, companies like this that are direct to consumer SaaS can really capture almost an entire market and define an entire market. In healthcare, it's very, very fragmented. So even in an area where you do have network effects, meaning there are significant switching costs to move from one product to another, like electronic health records, you do have two dominant players, Epic and Cerner, which together own about 60% of the market. But then the other 40% is covered by this long tail of over 100 EHR vendors, some of which are significant in size, even though maybe many of our listeners haven't heard of them. eClinical Works would be an example. Company just west of Boston. They do between 300 and 500 million in revenues a year. And they've grown organically, selling to independent physician practices for, I don't know, 15 years or so. So it's just healthcare, Russ, is a market that is extremely large, very fragmented, and there are significant inefficiencies. So if you're willing to fight it out and stick with it and have the staying power and deal with the complexity, there's a lot of opportunity to build really, really great technology businesses in this market.
So there is no doubt you are a brilliant person and know a massive amount about this industry, even fairly early in life, actually. But you've got to surround yourself with smart people and technologies to help you. How do you find all these great ideas and where to invest? I mean, is it, and what are the ratios? You look at 100 to pick one? Is it 1,000 to pick one? Is it 2 to pick one? How do you even get through that process to find these great ideas?
Great question. So, and different funds have different approaches to ensuring deal flow, which is the industry term for what you're talking about, is how do you find the right companies. And I think it's the conventional wisdom is that you have to be located in Silicon Valley or Boston to have a shot at that. And we are a Boston-based fund. We're also based in Salt Lake City, Utah. Both of those geographies give us significant advantages from a deal flow perspective. Intermountain Healthcare is an enormously innovative health system, as is the University of Utah. And you have Silicon Slopes, which has been a beneficiary, a hinterland of the Silicon Valley for a while. And I think last year, Utah had over $30 billion of quote unquote unicorn exits, meaning companies that were valued at close to or over $1 billion at time of acquisition or IPO. So it's a market that punches above its weight. Boston is obviously a healthcare technology hub itself. So part of it, Russ, is just being where the action is and being plugged into organic networks like the Harvard Innovation Lab or MIT's venture programs or Mass Challenge. And in Utah, there are a number of similar programs less far along, such as University of Utah Pivot program, where that's focused on out-licensing technology. So these are some of the basic ways, but something we've done at Springtide is to try and extend beyond our personal networks, is to bring in the maximum number of investors possible in Fund One. And that number is 100, at least to maintain your investment advisor exemption, which is important for SEC reasons, not important. The point is you can have up to 100 investors in a private equity fund. Most managers don't do that because it's a lot to manage and coordinate. We felt it was really important to do that because we could source deals from a much broader network. So if you think about it from a network science perspective, each investor is a node network. And if they're also serial entrepreneurs or medical providers or payers that have access to deal flow within their own communities and ecosystems, they can refer deals that fit Springtide's parameters, meaning post-revenue, data first, strong technical advisement, traction to us because they're invested. And so that's how we've approached it. It's taken us a couple of years to assemble this network, Russ, but most of our deal flow now comes from the network as opposed to Dan, Giannis, or myself.
That's awesome. So, you know, one of the things that I hear a lot, because you know our organization well enough, that we represent everything from the gigantic academic systems to a small critical access hospital with an IT staff of four and everything in between, including physician groups and long-term care. So it's a really full ecosystem kind of model. But what you often hear is, well, that venture stuff, that private equity stuff, that's just for those gigantic research organizations. The mid-sizes and the smalls, they don't have any role to play in any of this. And my personal belief, that's inaccurate. And so I'd love first, do you believe that's inaccurate? And if you hopefully do, how do they get involved? How does smaller organizations, community-based health systems, even physician offices get involved in this innovation, investing innovation development type environment?
That's a great question, Russ. And I think they're absolutely essential to fostering disruptive innovations within healthcare. And again, these are innovations that they're novel. They're the things that don't exist yet. And therefore, you need to find product market fit. You need to develop them with innovation partners. And just like you need to match the right capital to the right stage of company, and Springtide being a smaller venture fund, is therefore with the skills that we have and the focus that we have, we're the right partner for certain companies and not for others. The ones we're a good partner for are companies that are tech focused. They're working on solving a real problem in medicine. They've got some existing customers, but they need help on the sales front and to sort of formalize governance for their business and bring in additional capital now and secure it for the next several rounds of financing. So a lot of the large, just by way of analogy, a lot of the large legacy venture funds, Sequoia or Kleiner Perkins or the like, have reached a size that they can no longer invest in early stage companies. Because if they have multiple billions under management, each check you write suddenly has to be 50 million or above. And it becomes very difficult to make an investment, an appropriate investment, in a very early company that only needs so much capital and whose value is you know, 10 million or less. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done there to prove out a thesis, to build the right product and service. And so smaller health systems, you want to find the right partners at that stage too. You don't necessarily want to start with Mass General Brigham or IHC. That can be beneficial to have. You know, often I find myself advising our companies or those I meet with, Russ, to, yes, it's get a logo, but then work with smaller systems to solve problems they face, and they can be partners to you in unique ways, where you may not be ready for the bureaucracy and the 18-month sales cycles that you find at much larger systems. I think it's beneficial to start with smaller folks when you're small. And so then on the investing side, I would say that funds of our size have accessible minimum investment requirements for small providers. Again, if you're a very large fund, your minimums are probably inaccessible to all but the largest health systems. And so they're mostly raising from endowments and things of this nature. In our case, we're still focused on assembling a network where each investor can play an active role beyond just an investment of capital.
So, you know, you're still a fairly new organization. Now, over half your time even existing was in the world of COVID. So that counts for like a decade of real work, having to do anything during that. Just give me an idea of the vision you all have of the next few years, 3-4 years, you know, even what it looks like for raising your next fund. I think you said it's going to be $100 million fund. What's the process to do that? And more importantly, what impact do you want to make on healthcare?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So I'll answer the tactical part first of how are we going to raise a $100 million fund? Well, the good news is that so far we have a good relationship with all of our Fund One investors, and the vast majority of them we're having a final closing on the fund at the end of this quarter. The vast majority of them have already committed verbally to reinvest with us in Fund Two. So, and many of them larger amounts of capital than they did in Fund One. So we should have 30, 40 million ready to go on day one. We are in the process now of recruiting a few more full-time team members for Fund Two. And once that's done, we'll have our 2020 audit done. We've audited our performance and books starting in 2018. So we'll have 3 years audited track record, and we'll then meet with investment consultants like Cambridge Associates, who do work for the Intermountains and the Mass General Brighams and the endowments, to go through a full due diligence and try and find the right anchor investment partner. So this would be an organization that invests perhaps 20 million. We would share fund economics with them, which means that they would receive carried interest in the fund. I know some of these are particular industry terms, Russ. So basically what that means is they get additional financial benefits for investing early and being an anchor investor and investing a certain amount that's larger. At that point, hopefully by end of summer, early fall, we'll have a first closing on the fund and begin. That just means that we start to call capital from our investors for specific investments. And so at that point, the fund's fully operational and we continue fundraising and we look for perhaps more strategic investors at that point. The right mix of health systems, payers, And we again try and optimize the LP base, limited partner base for Fund Two. We have a final closing when we reach about 100 million. Again, beyond that point, we would be receiving more management fees, but we would have to start investing differently and in ways that probably would mean reduced performance. So in general, the more money you have under management, the lower your returns are. And there are exceptions to that, but we think 100 million is about the right size for a fund like Springtide that's scoped in the way we are. So at that point, we'll by the end of the year is the goal, have Fund Two in place. The second part of your question was around how do we want to impact healthcare over the next few years? And that starts here at home, where we are investing in things that can improve healthcare within the US context. Things that first improve administrative processes and make them much more efficient, then move up the spectrum of clinical value to touch clinical decision support, things of this nature, and eventually becoming very powerful diagnostic tools like what we read about with radiology or pathology image interpretation. And we think the general intelligence of those algorithms will become great enough to really accrue significant value. But that's not the world we live in quite yet today. So that's the US context. We'll raise a new fund every couple of years with the right set of investors in the US. We also have a global vision of setting up funds in different regions of the world, starting with Fund Three. So we'd have Springtide Fund One East Asia, Springtide Fund One South Asia, Europe, Latin America. And each of those would be sized appropriately for their markets and done in partnership with an organization on the ground there. So Apollo Hospitals in India, for instance, is an organization we've had some experience with. And we think that's the right way to grow as an investment firm, as opposed to raising ever larger funds in a specific geography like the US. Because again, your returns are going to start to fall, even though you as a manager are going to do better on management fees. So maybe that's more information that you wanted, but what we really want to achieve, Russ, is we want to bring quality healthcare to everyone in the world. And we think that some of these technologies really can help with that. And so we want to help with that on a global scale.
Well, you know, it's funny you even mentioned the name Apollo. I was just on the phone with Dr. Reddy and Arvind, their CIO, just yesterday morning. They are truly special people over there. And there's a lot of special people all over the world, especially in the United States. But you're one of those. I know for our members in particular, this many things you talked about today, and I pretend like I knew enough about it to get us through this podcast. There's so much that we still need to understand, because this is becoming a daily part of really leading the digital frontier in healthcare. And are there resources? Are there places? Obviously you're part of Chime, so our Chime members can get a hold of you if they want to talk. Other things you think people should be doing to just learn this environment?
Yes. for those listening who might be technically inclined, there's a course. It's an open source course at MIT called AI for Healthcare that anyone can take for free. It's a significant investment of time, but that's for those who are technically inclined. If there's a great book that Eric Topol wrote recently called Deep Medicine. And this is all about the AI landscape in healthcare today and looking forward. And I think he does a great job with the book. So I'd recommend those two resources. And of course, being active in Chime, as we hope to be. And there are a number of conferences that are held. We actually held our inaugural Healthcare AI Summit last fall, where we showcased what we felt were 20 of the world's best healthcare AI startups. And the CEOs of these companies shared that, you know, it was a lightning pitch format. So 5 minutes each, they shared what they're doing, the problems they're solving. And I think it was an intellectually rewarding experience for the attendees. We had several hundred folks show up. We had the former CEO of United Health speak as a keynote, Steve Nelson. We had former CEO of Siemens North America, Dr. Greg Sorensen, who's a radiologist, speak. He's had the only exit to our knowledge in radiology AI with his company DeepHealth, which was acquired by RadNet last year. And so I think that's another resource. It's a little self-serving of me to mention that, but we have a healthcare AI summit every year. And so specialized fora can be a great resource as well.
Well, any closing thoughts? Is unfortunately our time is up today on this podcast, but any closing thoughts you'd like to share?
It's an exciting time to be in healthcare. And I think that while shifts in the landscape like meaningful use have been really frustrating for a lot of clinicians and the administrators that need to manage these transitions and processes, that these things go up and down. And I think it's a really exciting time where technologies like artificial intelligence are helping to make things better from this point. And that applies to genomics. It enables precision medicine eventually, and pharmacogenomics enabling precision targeting of biologics. Nutrition, there's so much data available now that humans literally are unable to process. So I think that it's an exciting time to be alive and involved in healthcare. We're going to see a lot of great advances in human health and well-being in the coming years.
Well, Austin, thanks so much for sharing your knowledge today, your passion for this space. I learned a lot today and probably wrote about 10 words down that I still need to go look up later. I just greatly appreciate you having on this, being on the program with us.
Thank you very much, Russ. I enjoyed it.
Hey, and to our Chime listeners out there for this podcast and everything, if you want more resources, there's actually some in. Our own Chief Innovation Officer, Jonathan Fritz, can always help you and can get you connected with great people like Austin along the way. But in the meantime, thank you for joining us for this episode of the Leader to Leader podcast. As always, you can listen to this and all of our programs on chimecentral.org/media, Apple, or Spotify. But for now, please take care, stay home. If you're out in public, you better be wearing your mask. Let's get our shots. Be safe and God bless.